employees who left the labor force because they were too ill to work. Employers and governments around the world have instituted programs to enhance employee health and well-being. Such initiatives, however, focus almost exclusively on influencing individual decisions, such as those concerning diet, exercise, smoking, and alcohol and substance abuse, leaving in the context the work environment that affects people's stress levels and consequently their behavior largely untouched. Such health improvement programs are particularly common in the United States, where employers have traditionally been more directly responsible for paying for employee health insurance and, thus, indirectly employees' health care costs. A Rand Corporation report evaluating employee wellness programs noted that almost 50% of the employers in the United States with more than 50 employees and 92% with more than 200 employees offered some sort of wellness promotion program in 2009. These programs encourage employees and their families to exercise, give up smoking, eat a healthier diet, restrict their alcohol intake, and monitor various biomarkers such as blood pressure and cholesterol to keep them at healthy levels. A survey of some 800 large and mid-sized employers by the consulting firm Aon Hewitt reported that 79% used rewards such as lower insurance premiums to try to get people to improve their health. Increasingly, Aon Hewitt found, companies were also imposing penalties for employees who did not improve on various biometric and lifestyle measures. Although employers are obviously concerned about health insurance costs and also employee absence, turnover, and productivity, and therefore attempt to improve these outcomes as they are affected by individual health, the focus of most wellness programs is too narrow to accomplish much. Employer interventions such as nutritional and stress counseling and exercise classes and the modest financial incentives offered to workers to induce them to participate in wellness screenings and even public policy interventions such as cigarette taxes focus almost exclusively on getting individuals to make decisions to engage in lifestyle changes. As one example, the large grocery store chain Safeway has received much attention for its Healthy Measures program. That CEO-inspired initiative offered employees reductions in their health insurance premium contributions if they stayed within certain predetermined limits on smoking, obesity, blood pressure, and cholesterol. The assumption of this and similar programs is that if you improve people's knowledge about nutrition and exercise, offer them exercise and stress reduction opportunities, measure their health status, and possibly offer some financial inducements for participating, these interventions will be sufficient to get behavioral change. The problem is that employers seldom consider the workplace itself and what occurs there as important causal factors affecting individual behavior. Such neglect is unfortunate because extensive research shows that individual health-relevant decisions such as drinking, smoking, drug abuse, and overeating are profoundly affected by job-related conditions. For instance, we know that work hours are long in many law firms that are also often characterized by very interpersonally competitive cultures. A New York Times article reported that 21% of lawyers qualify as problem drinkers, while 28% struggle with mild or more serious depression and 19% with anxiety. Moreover, as that article noted, many lawyers apparently have serious drug addiction issues that start by using stimulants to help them maintain their demanding schedules. The work environment affects how people think about their lives and also their level of psychological well-being. Not surprisingly, people who do not like their lives are less likely to take good care of themselves. As psychiatrist Richard Friedman, explaining addiction, wrote, "No one will be shocked to learn that stress makes people more likely to search for solace in drugs or food. It's called comfort food for a reason." Now we have a body of research that makes the connection between stress and addiction definitive. More surprisingly, it shows we can change the path to addiction by changing our environment. Companies know about these work environment effects, but nonetheless fail to act. For instance, a 2008 study by human resource consulting firm Watson Wyatt, now Towers Watson, found that 48% of organizations said that job-related stress, caused by long work hours and lean staffing policies that resulted in fewer people doing more work, affected business performance. However, only 5% of the employers said they were doing anything to address these health and performance-related issues. Because the job conditions that affect health are not the primary focus of most employer wellness interventions, not surprisingly, workplace wellness programs often don't work very well, although the evidence on their success is mixed. The first important fact about wellness programs is that only a tiny fraction of these interventions have been evaluated at all. Second, an important issue with workplace wellness programs is employee participation. For instance, supermarket chain HEB found that annual healthcare claims were about $1,500 less for participants in its workplace wellness program. But a RAND study reported that employee participation rates frequently were not that high, with fewer than half of employees in workplaces offering wellness programs participating. A Gallup survey found that only 24% of employees at companies that offer wellness programs actively participate in it. Even at Stanford University, which has a long-running, well-administered, comprehensive leadership-supported program with financial incentives for participation, a significant fraction of employees, more than 35%, do not avail themselves of the program. One meta-analysis of 32 published studies concluded that medical costs fall by about $3.27 for every dollar spent on wellness programs, and that absentee costs fall by about $2.73 for every dollar spent. However, a more recent comprehensive analysis concluded that wellness programs produce a return on investment of less than 1-to-1 savings to cost. And a study of PepsiCo's wellness program, Healthy Living, found that 7 years of continuous participation in one or both components of the program was associated with an average reduction of $30 in healthcare cost per member per month, with the disease management component accounting for the lower costs, while the lifestyle-altering component had no effect. The RAND report found that wellness programs had some effect on lifestyle choices such as diet and exercise, but an analysis of more than 360,000 employees from 5 employers noted that the difference in healthcare costs between people who participated in wellness programs and those who did not was just $157 annually, an amount that is neither statistically nor substantively significant. You can't expect people to adopt healthy lifestyles when their work environments reinforce or even cause poor habits. Separate from debates about the effectiveness of employer-initiated workplace wellness programs, it is quite instructive to think about the criteria most often used to evaluate these wellness interventions. Evaluations focus almost exclusively on healthcare costs. Costs obviously are important, but maybe, just maybe, assessments of employee wellness programs should also focus on employees' wellness and well-being, their health, both physical and mental, and even their mortality and morbidity. Health status is not perfectly correlated with costs. After all, if a person drops dead, healthcare spending stops. Privileging economic costs over human well-being shouldn't occur as thoughtlessly as it now does, and costs certainly should not be the sole criterion used in assessing whether wellness programs worked or did not. Employer choices and healthcare system performance. Discussions of health and healthcare choices often begin, as I have noted, by focusing on individual choices. One analysis estimated that poor individual decisions concerning diet, exercise, and substance abuse contributed to more than 1 million of the 2.4 million annual deaths in the United States. In addition to individual decisions, much public policy discussion and empirical research focuses on 2 other possible causes of the underperformance of the U.S. healthcare system, where underperformance means spending a large amount of money without obtaining better health outcomes. To be clear, the United States, despite being a leading source of drug and medical device innovation, and despite enormous investments in technology and health infrastructure, clearly underperforms. According to the OECD, the United States spends $7,662 per person, adjusted for purchasing power parity, on health, which is 2.6 times the OECD average and is the highest amount in the world. America devotes 16.9% of its GDP to health care, 1.8 times the OECD average, and again has the highest proportion in the world. Nonetheless, the United States ranks just 27th for life expectancy at birth, 53rd in deaths per 1,000 live births, a measure of infant mortality, and 23rd in life expectancy for men aged 65. One focus for reducing health costs and improving health system performance has been on societal-level choices such as the way the healthcare system is organized and paid for, and the administrative cost burden thereby created. Because the administration of much healthcare reimbursement in the United States has been left to insurance companies, the evidence suggests that the United States confronts a particularly large administrative overhead expense of about 30%. Such expense is an almost inevitable result of healthcare providers having to deal with a multitude of insurance companies and insurance companies transacting with numerous providers. A related, more macro-level focus has been on what insurance should and should not be required to cover. For example, pre-existing conditions, birth control, and alternative health therapies. Yet another macro-level focus has been how to pay for the medical costs of the aging populations that most advanced industrialized countries confront, and particularly how the cost burden should be shared between individuals and the larger society. A second focus on the determinants of health system performance has been on the internal administrative dynamics of healthcare organizations that actually deliver care, including how to ensure that the incentives providers face work to ensure cost-effective care. For example, there have been studies of the effectiveness of incentive pay and also analyses of practices that encourage learning and continuous improvement in healthcare organizations. These are important factors to consider, of course, but ignoring the effects of employer actions that determine workplace conditions seems singularly unwise. Looking at what employers do daily to create healthy or harmful workplaces is a crucial missing piece of the story of human well-being, health, and healthcare costs. Consider as just one example the effects of employer decisions about wages. Although wages are partly determined by labor market conditions, there are low-wage and higher-wage employers in the same industry, Costco and Walmart being one example of such differences. And the evidence is clear. Wages affect health. For instance, a study of more than 17,000 people using panel study of income dynamics data reported a negative and strongly statistically significant correlation between wages and the self-reported, based on a physician's diagnosis, incidence of hypertension. The data show that the higher the wages earned, the lower the likelihood of reporting high blood pressure. The effect of wages on health was greater for women and for younger working people between 25 and 44 years old. This was a prospective longitudinal study, so that wages in an earlier wave of the study were used to predict newly diagnosed high blood pressure, thereby helping to establish the direction of the causal relationship. The evidence showed that a doubling of wages was related to a 25 to 30% diminished risk of hypertension. Many other employer decisions affecting work hours and work-family conflict also affect health, as we will see throughout this audiobook. My fundamental message is simple. Employers have a choice. They can implement practices that enhance human well-being, physical and mental health, thereby reducing their own costs from employee medical expenses, absenteeism, workers' compensation insurance costs, and the productivity loss from having employees who are physically at work but not really there, a problem called presentism in the research literature. Such employer actions will also reduce the costs to society from people's poor physical and mental health and the harm done to individuals. Simply put, employers can make decisions to improve people's lives in fundamentally important ways. Or, alternatively, employers can, either intentionally or through ignorance and neglect, create workplaces that literally sicken and kill people. If we want to build a healthier society, develop policies that promote social sustainability and healthy workplaces, and cut unnecessary healthcare costs and sickness and death, one important place to focus is on workplace-specific interventions that enhance people's health and the social sustainability of work organizations. Chapter 2: The Enormous Toll of Toxic Workplaces. Workplaces can be hazardous to your health, even at a for-profit employer of primary care doctors. A now former employee, let's call her Susan, described the toll of too much work on her and some of her colleagues, and a CEO who freaked out if things didn't get done. I was just talking to one of our VPs the other day. She was breaking out in shingles because of the stress. This past summer, I had a panic attack, and that had never happened to me before. I got to the point where I was so unhappy I was in tears every day, hating what I was doing. Just as office manager, I was juggling a job that should have been for two people, if not two and a half. In my research, I heard a plethora of stories and anecdotes, and I came across many articles and much data about workplace stress and its consequences. The challenge? To find the data and do the analyses that would, with reasonable accuracy, estimate the economic and human toll of harmful management practices. That is the subject of this chapter. For almost a decade, I have believed that harmful workplaces adversely affect physical and mental health and exact a tremendous economic and human cost. Moreover, it is management decisions that create toxic work environments, and it is management decisions that could, and in too few cases do, fix them. But if people are literally dying for a paycheck, if harmful work practices exact enormous costs, then it seems to me that we ought to address at least four questions that would help define the scope of the problem. How truly harmful, how bad, are a set of identifiable and reasonably common dimensions of contemporary work environments? What is the aggregate toll, both in lives and dollars, of these workplace exposures in the United States? To what extent might the differential exposure to harmful work environments explain the ever-growing inequalities in health outcomes, such as lifespans? And, most important, how much of the human and economic toll might be preventable, given the facts of economic competition and technological change that make the goal of creating no workplace stress seemingly impossible? Addressing these questions required analytic and modeling skills far beyond my capabilities. I was fortunate to be able to induce Joel Goh, at the time a doctoral student at the Stanford Graduate School of Business and now a professor at the National University of Singapore, and Stefanos Xenios, a chaired professor in our Operations and Information Technology Group, to help me answer these four questions. This chapter describes what we learned and highlights the work of other researchers and countries that also sheds light on these topics as well as other dimensions of the toll bad workplaces are exacting. For those not interested in the details, such as which workplace exposures are the most harmful and how we went about putting together our analyses, here are our best estimates of the answers to each of the questions we posed. The 10 workplace exposures we identified and studied are, with almost no exceptions, as harmful to health, including mortality and having a physician-diagnosed illness, as exposure to secondhand smoke, a known and regulated carcinogen. In total, workplace environments in the United States may be responsible for 120,000 excess deaths per year, which would make workplaces the fifth leading cause of death, and account for about $180 billion in additional healthcare expenditures, approximately 8% of the total healthcare spending. Differential exposure to harmful workplace environments, largely affected by people's level of education, and to a much, much smaller extent by race and gender, account for somewhere between 10 and 38% of the growing inequality in lifespans. By comparing the United States to a set of 27 countries in Europe, we estimate that about 60,000, or half of the deaths, and about $63 billion, or one-third of the excess costs, might be preventable. Other research also points to a high human and economic toll. One empirical approach focuses on the percentage of specific diseases that are attributable to workplace conditions. so-called attributable fractions, AF. Using that method, a UC Davis researcher estimated that in 2007, there were 5,600 fatal injuries and 53,000 fatal illnesses attributable to workplace conditions, with a cost at least as large as the cost of cancer. Another study, employing the same methodology and using 1997 data, estimated 49,000 deaths, which would make occupational death the eighth leading cause of death in the United States. In Australia, workplace stress costs the economy about $14.8 billion a year, according to one estimate, with work pressure, harassment, and bullying comprising some 75% of psychological injury claims. Moreover, the executive director of the Australian Psychological Society reported that a stress and well-being survey revealed a downward trend in psychological health and well-being, a pattern observed in the United States as well. A survey of methods designed to measure health-related productivity losses reported that in the United States, approximately $260 billion in output is lost each year because of health-related problems. A study reported in a Chinese journal in 2006 estimated that at least 1 million people in China currently die from overwork each year. A report from the Shanghai Academy of Science and Technology reported that as many as 70% of China's intellectuals, mostly university professors, faced, to a greater or lesser degree, the risk of premature death from exhaustion. And an analysis using World Health Organization comparative risk assessment methods to calculate the burden of occupational hazards estimated that there were 850,000 deaths worldwide and a loss of 24 million years of healthy life. The European Agency for Safety and Health at Work estimated that stress accounted for 60% of all lost days in the workplace. These estimates all speak to a staggering human and economic toll from harmful workplace practices. Other causes of people's health. One might wonder whether other factors might explain healthcare costs and mortality. Although the workplace is an important environment for people, it is obviously not the only setting or the only cause of health issues. For instance, the family has an important effect on health. As one early analysis noted, the family constitutes perhaps the most important social context within which illness occurs and is resolved. It consequently serves as a primary unit in health and medical care. A large and growing research literature also demonstrates the importance of the community where one lives on people's health and well-being. A study in Hamilton, Ontario, Canada, found that the socioeconomic composition of neighborhoods affected health status and the strength of the relationship between smoking and health. Another analysis using data from Chicago examined the role of residential instability, immigrant concentration, and socioeconomic status on health. Communities matter for health because of the social and material resources, including the availability of healthcare resources that vary by community. Social networks and interpersonal relationships also affect health. The effects of social relations on health derive from many pathways, including the effects of people's connections on their individual behaviors. Consider some examples of this effect. One study found that being overweight moved through social networks in a process of social contagion. An individual's chances of becoming obese increased by some 57% if that individual had a friend who became obese in a given time period. A review of the research literature concerning social effects on alcohol use described three mechanisms that helped explain peer influence on drinking. Peers actually offering or supplying alcohol, peers modeling alcohol consumption, and peer behavior that helps determine social norms and expectations about what is appropriate alcohol consumption. Studies of drug use consistently concluded that the social environment plays a critical role in determining the likelihood that an individual will use drugs or will develop a drug use disorder. In many important ways, people are influenced by their peers, and this effect occurs for health-relevant behaviors as well. This powerful influence of peers on behavior is one reason that substance abuse programs typically provide mentors and social support for people to call when they need help modifying their behavior. And such programs frequently incorporate efforts to change with whom people associate, so that they remove themselves from the influence of others who are engaging in self-harming behaviors. Moreover, social relationships can also provide friendship and emotional support, people to talk to, which can reduce the harmful effects of stress. Other factors, too, influence health and longevity. For instance, genetics and random chance, such as being in an automobile accident or inadvertently purchasing a car with mechanical issues, affect people's health and mortality. As one medical article noted, genes affect virtually every human characteristic and disease. Thus, not all disease or ill health is controllable by what individuals do. Nor is all disease and death the result of what happens to people in the workplace. However, the workplace has very important effects on health. Estimating the health effects of workplace exposures. The job is where working people spend time, where they earn their income, where they attain, or not, social status and prestige. In the United States, a job is where employers decided, at least prior to the passage of the Affordable Care Act, and to some extent even after that law was passed, if, and what kind of, health insurance, and therefore what kind of health care access employees would have. Workplaces can be stress-filled or not. Extensive research, published over decades, consistently shows the adverse health effects of stress and even some of the causal pathways, for instance by inducing unhealthy individual choices. Any workplace practice that increases stress makes human well-being worse and healthcare costs higher, while any management practice that either directly mitigates stress or provides ways of coping with it increases well-being and reduces healthcare costs correspondingly. And because health and longevity are directly related to being able to access health, workplace policies such as the provision of health insurance and the cost of accessing health care through that insurance also have consequences for both people's physical and psychological well-being and their economic security. It ought to be straightforward to estimate the effects of workplace practices on health and the associated costs. But it is not, because no longitudinal data provide measures of both people's work environments and their health over time. Thus, Go, Xenios, and I had to use indirect estimation methods and data from numerous sources in a model to calculate the physical and economic costs of harmful management practices. Readers interested in the methods and the sensitivity analyses we used to ensure that the numbers were robust should consult the technical details available in peer-reviewed published articles. We used a straightforward and logical analytical process. First, we assessed the prevalence of employer practices and workplace conditions, which we called work exposures, that reasonably would be expected to adversely or positively affect employee health. We used data from several waves of the General Social Survey, a national random sample that measures attitudes and conditions that people experience in their lives, to estimate the extent to which the population was exposed to various workplace conditions. Then we used meta-analysis, a procedure for combining the results from multiple studies, to estimate the magnitude of the effects of the workplace exposures on mortality and morbidity above what would be expected for people who did not confront these workplace circumstances. Finally, we estimated the costs of these adverse health outcomes using national data on medical costs for people with different levels of health. Throughout this process, we employed a variety of techniques to guard against double counting the effects of multiple workplace exposures or, for that matter, multiple negative health outcomes that might result. Our review of the epidemiological literature uncovered 10 prominent workplace exposures related to employer decisions that affect human health and longevity. 1. Being unemployed. Sometimes, although not invariably, a consequence of being laid off. 2. Not having health insurance. 3. Working shifts, as opposed to customary daytime workdays, and also working longer periods, such as 10 or 12-hour shifts, as contrasted with the more customary 8 hours. 4. Working long hours in a week, e.g., more than 40 hours. 5. Confronting job insecurity, for example, because colleagues had been laid off or fired. 6. Facing family to work and work to family conflicts. 7. Having relatively low control over one's job and job environment, including having relatively little freedom and decision discretion at work. 8. Facing high job demands, such as pressure to work fast. 9. Being in a work environment that offered low levels of social support, for instance, not having close relationships with coworkers that provide social support to mitigate the effects of work stress. And 10. Working in a setting in which job and employment-related decisions seemed unfair. For most of these measures, we used data from several of the most recent waves of the General Social Survey to estimate the frequency of occurrence of these conditions in U.S. workplaces. Then we did a search of the online database Medline for articles that contain terms corresponding to these workplace conditions and health status. Our initial search uncovered almost 3,000 articles. This large number of studies suggests that A. There is a large epidemiological literature relating elements of the work environment to health. And B. The work environment dimensions we started with were a reasonable place to begin to estimate the effects of job circumstances on health. To make the meta-analysis task manageable, we used only those articles that employed relatively large samples, more than 1,000 people, and articles that utilized the most advanced and appropriate statistical methods. In the end, we incorporated the results of more than 200 studies for our meta-analyses of the mortality effects of workplace practices. We used these studies to derive estimates of the magnitude of the health effects of the various workplace exposures, which, of course, vary in the severity of their consequences for people's well-being. While there have been other prior reviews and meta-analyses of the effects of workplace conditions on health, many of these have focused on single workplace stressors such as job insecurity, work hours, the absence of social support in the workplace, and psychological demands and job discretion. What our empirical estimates add to the existing research literature is that our results incorporate the most recent empirical findings and employ common methods and criteria to investigate the effects of 10 workplace dimensions on 4 health outcomes. The 4 health outcomes we considered are mortality, presence of a physician-diagnosed illness or medical condition, self-reported mental health, and self-reported physical health. The research literature typically identifies health problems and mortality as either present or absent, a convention that we also followed. It is important to note that self-reported physical health, whether measured by a single item or a scale, has been shown to be a significant predictor of subsequent mortality and morbidity, even after statistically controlling for other health-relevant factors. Moreover, this prospective ability of self-reported health to predict subsequent illness and death holds across different ethnicities and ages, so the value of self-reported health as a measure apparently is quite general. Many workplace practices are as harmful as secondhand smoke. In the medical literature, health effects are typically reported as odds ratios, a practice my colleagues and I followed when we did the meta-analyses. An odds ratio of 2, for instance, would mean that someone exposed to a particular workplace stressor would have twice the odds of experiencing a particular health outcome, such as mortality or a physician-diagnosed condition, as someone not so exposed. To non-scientists, interpreting an odds ratio, how substantively important is the effect, is often difficult. Therefore, to provide some context for ascertaining the practical importance of the results of our analyses summarizing the effects of workplace stressors on health, we compared our effect sizes with the health effects of exposure to secondhand smoke. Secondhand smoke is a known environmental carcinogen. More important, because of the recognized adverse health effects of exposure to secondhand smoke, public policy in the United States, and increasingly throughout most of the world, has focused on implementing regulations that reduce the chances of exposure to this hazard. Consequently, smoking is no longer permitted on public transportation, such as airplanes, trains, or buses, or in offices, restaurants, theaters, and many other public places. Odds ratios higher than 1 indicate that the exposures listed here increase the odds of negative health outcomes. No health insurance, for instance, increased the odds of a physician-diagnosed health condition by more than 100%. Estimating the aggregate health effects of workplace exposures on mortality. An adverse health effect of a workplace exposure that occurs infrequently is not something that would prompt organizational or public policy interventions. Health outcomes are determined both by the extent to which some exposure leads to adverse health consequences and also the prevalence of that exposure. The next task my colleagues and I undertook was to estimate the aggregate health effects of all 10 exposures on 2 outcomes of great interest, mortality and healthcare costs. I present the results for the analysis of mortality first. Employing a model designed to reduce the likelihood of double counting, Go, Zinios, and I estimated that the number of total excess deaths each year attributable to the 10 workplace conditions was about 120,000 people. To put this number in perspective, this is more deaths coming from poor, unhealthy, stressful workplace conditions than the number of deaths resulting from diabetes, Alzheimer's, influenza, or kidney disease, and about as many deaths as were reported in 2010 from both accidents and strokes. The data on deaths by cause come from the Centers for Disease Control. We also estimated the marginal contribution of each workplace condition to mortality. Note that for statistical reasons, the numbers do not add up to the number estimated overall. Workplace exposures and excess mortality. Workplace condition, unemployment. Annual excess deaths, 35,000. No insurance, 50,000. Shift work, 13,000. Long work hours, 0. Job insecurity, 29,000. Work-family conflict, 0. Low job control, 17,000. Low social support, 3,000. Low fairness, no data. High job demands, 8,000. The absence of health insurance is the employment condition leading to the greatest number of excess deaths, followed by being unemployed and then by job insecurity. Shift work is associated with 13,000 excess deaths. An absence of job control and discretion at work is also an important contributor to excess mortality, causing some 17,000 excess deaths per year. Previous research has identified job control as an important factor predicting cardiovascular incidents and mortality. Our research is consistent with that finding, and also supports previously reported studies that demonstrate the impact of not having health insurance on mortality. Some factors that do contribute to increased costs do not increase mortality in our data. They make people sick, but don't kill them. It is important to note that psychosocial aspects of work, such as insecurity, low social support, and not having control over the conditions of one's work, have important effects on excess deaths. Is this estimate reasonable? The figure of 120,000 deaths per year makes workplace management practices the 5th leading cause of death in the United States. Is the workplace really that important for human health and well-being? Without excessively belaboring the point, here are some reasons why I believe this estimate is, as it was designed to be, conservative in its assessment of the toll of the workplace on mortality. Implications from a study of the effects of individual choices on health. About a decade ago, Ralph Keeney of the Fuqua School of Business at Duke University published a paper in which he argued, using a mathematical modeling approach and existing data, that of the 2.4 million deaths that occurred in 2000, 1 million were the result of personal decisions. He also showed that 55% of the deaths for people between the ages of 15 and 64 were the result of personal decisions. Keeney's conclusion? Individual choices concerning behaviors such as smoking, eating, obesity, exercise, and alcohol abuse were a substantial cause of death. Keeney argued that these personal choices about health-relevant behaviors could be changed to reduce the mortality rate in the United States. Keeney's conclusion is, in its tone, no different from the assumption underlying many organizationally sponsored health improvement efforts, that intervening to affect individual behaviors and decisions can affect population health to lower healthcare costs. But what Keeney and many health improvement efforts overlook is that studies consistently demonstrate the connection between stress, including workplace-induced stress, and unhealthy individual behaviors such as overeating. Other empirical research demonstrates the effects of stress on individual behaviors such as alcohol consumption, cigarette smoking, and drug abuse. These are precisely the types of personal decisions that Keeney implicated in his analysis of the toll of personal choices on mortality. There is no reason to believe that the effects of workplace stress on these unhealthy behaviors would be different from any other source of stress. Individuals respond to stress, as many examples in this book illustrate, by self-medicating with drugs or alcohol to numb the psychological pain of an unhealthy workplace. People compensate for the psychological depletion of energy from a stressful work environment by overeating. Keeney's analysis suggested there are 1 million excess deaths from individual choices. We know that stress affects these individual choices to eat too much, not exercise, take drugs, and abuse alcohol and smoke. We further know that the workplace is an important, if not one of the most important, causes of stress. Consequently, attributing only about 12% of the total toll from individual choices on mortality to workplace-induced stress seems quite reasonable, if not conservative. The physiological mechanisms linking stress to health. We don't just observe an empirical relationship between the presence of stress and health outcomes. Over time, we have learned more precisely how harmful stress is and the ways in which stress produces adverse physiological responses. Research increasingly demonstrates the effects of stress on disease. For instance, for men, prolonged exposure to work-related stress has been linked to an increased likelihood of lung, colon, rectal, and stomach cancer, and non-Hodgkin lymphoma. Moreover, we are increasingly understanding the mechanisms linking stress to disease. Our evolutionary ancestors faced a world filled with threats. When confronted with some physical threat, organisms that could either outfight or outrun the threat had a survival advantage. Therefore, it was adaptive, in the presence of a stressor, a threat, to exhibit an elevated heart rate that would move blood and oxygen more efficiently through the body, to muscles that would be useful for escape or conflict, to have heightened awareness and sensitivity to better apprehend one's surroundings, and to react more quickly to a perceived threat. However, what is adaptive in response to episodic short-term threats, a metabolic response that raises the pulse rate, is unhealthy in the presence of chronic stress. As I noted in a paper with Berkeley social psychologist Dana Carney, when a person perceives the demands of a situation to exceed his or her own resources, the mind makes sense of this discrepancy by appraising it as a threat. If the stress response is strong enough, the result is elevated cortisol levels. Cortisol is a catabolic, i.e., cell-breaking down, hormone with links to chronic stress, systemic inflammation, accelerated cellular death, and generally poor health. Evidence shows that although elevated cortisol is adaptive in the face of a short-term immediate threat, constantly elevated cortisol and other hormones produced in response to stress adversely affect health. These physiological pathways from stress to ill health provide causal explanations of how workplace stress can lead to sickness and death. The importance of the workplace as a source of stress. In addition, the available evidence consistently indicates that the workplace is an important source of stress and that many, if not most, of the causes of workplace stress are getting worse. For instance, economic insecurity has increased as the frequency of layoffs has grown, and more people work in increasingly transitory, contingent work arrangements. Fewer companies offer health insurance as a benefit, and many of the costs of health care have been shifted to employees with ever-increasing deductibles and co-payments, a topic I examine in Chapter 4. Job control and job autonomy have diminished with the increasing availability and use of computer-based monitoring of work and work processes. Work hours have increased as global competition has intensified work, a topic explored in more detail in Chapter 5, where I consider the effects of work hours on health. Work-family conflict has grown with the availability of technologies that keep people always connected to their workplace and with the rise in working hours. Shift work and irregular work hours are more common as the hours of operation of establishments, ranging from airports to food services, have increased to be able to meet consumer demands whenever they occur. Fewer countries require stores to close on Sunday. To take a simple example, when I first began going to Barcelona in 2006, few stores were open on Sunday. Now, many more are, a trend occurring in many countries as the hours of operation of all sorts of businesses have expanded. In short, although some workplaces have tried to do things to enhance employee health and well-being, for the most part, workplace stressors have grown in frequency and importance over time. Thus, it is completely reasonable to presume that the health effects of workplace stress are large and increasing. The effects of workplace practices on health costs. As I argued in Chapter 1, healthcare costs bedevil both employers and governments, not just in the United States, but all over the world. This focus on curtailing healthcare costs raises this important question. How much do the 10 workplace exposures we have identified cost? Just indirect healthcare costs, and not considering productivity losses and other costs these workplace practices may impose. Go, Xenios, and I, as part of our research, also derived estimates for the incremental costs of people's exposure to harmful workplace circumstances. Fortunately, the U.S. government surveys people to ascertain their self-reported physical and mental health and whether or not they have been diagnosed with any one of a number of major disease categories. The survey, the Medical Expenditure Panel Survey, household component, conducted by the Agency for Healthcare Research and Quality, also asks about the total of all direct payments for medical care during the year, including out-of-pocket expenses and costs paid by insurance, Medicaid, Medicare, and any other sources. These data permit us to estimate costs by an individual's health status. Combining the information on the effects of workplace conditions on various measures of health status, the information on what medical conditions and self-reported poor health cost on average, and the prevalence of the various workplace circumstances that contribute to poor health, permits us to estimate the total costs of workplace exposures, as well as the extra health care costs attributable to each specific workplace exposure. My co-authors and I estimated that the incremental healthcare costs from stress-inducing work conditions is about $190 billion annually, or approximately between 5 and 8% of the total U.S. healthcare budget. The inescapable conclusion? Workplace conditions are a significant contributor to healthcare costs in the United States. Incremental healthcare costs by workplace exposure. Workplace condition? Unemployment. Annual excess healthcare costs, $15 billion. No insurance, $40 billion. Shift work, $12 billion. Long work hours, $13 billion. Low fairness, $16 billion. Job insecurity, $16 billion. Work-family conflict, $24 billion. High job demands, $46 billion. Low job control, $11 billion. Low social support, $9 billion. The biggest contributors to excess healthcare expenditures are not having insurance, work-family conflict, and high job demands. Note that there isn't complete correspondence between the factors that make health costs higher and those that result in excess deaths. That's partly because the chronic illnesses caused by stress-related factors, such as work-family conflict and high job demands, create health conditions that result in people using the healthcare system more intensively, but not necessarily dying. When someone dies, healthcare costs stop, which is why chronic diseases that persist over a long period of time often cost more than, for instance, sudden death from a heart attack, an outcome that research shows follows from layoffs and job loss. Even more than was true for mortality, psychosocial elements of the work environment, such as fairness, work-family conflict, high job demands, and low control over a person's work environment contribute to excess healthcare costs. Our cost estimates are almost certainly low for the following reasons. First, as already noted, the analysis considers only direct medical costs that come from one of the four measures of health. self-reported physical and mental health, a physician-diagnosed health condition, or mortality. Our analyses do not consider any other costs, such as loss of working time or diminished productivity from suffering from a health problem. Indirect costs from things such as disengagement, being physically present but not feeling well enough to do one's best, and being distracted by stress are typically estimated to be about 5 times as large as the direct medical costs, an issue I return to toward the end of this chapter. Second, our analyses estimate the healthcare costs, just as they do the increased mortality, experienced solely by the individual who directly faces the various workplace exposures, without considering any possible spillover effects to family and friends. In the cases of absence of health insurance, work-family conflict, and economic insecurity, for example, the likelihood of spillover effects to other family members seems high. Access to health insurance occurs or does not occur for everyone in the immediate family. Work-family conflict affects family members besides the focal employee. And the stress arising from the economic insecurity that comes from the threat of layoffs or highly variable wages and work hours likely impacts everyone in a household. The conclusion about costs is the same as the conclusion about mortality. Workplace practices have an important effect on the healthcare costs companies and society confront. This means that workplace arrangements are one reasonable place to intervene in an effort to reduce such costs. Is the health toll preventable? When my colleagues and I put our research paper through the peer review process, one anonymous reviewer made an important point. The odds ratios from epidemiological studies and our analyses necessarily compared the health effects and costs of workplaces with varying management practices to a counterfactual world in which there was no workplace-induced stress at all. But such a world does not, and possibly cannot, exist. After all, companies face competitive pressures, and they pass at least some of that pressure on to their workforce, be it in the form of long hours, work-family conflict, or the economic insecurity that arises naturally in dynamic economies where firms rise and fall and employment fluctuates. So, we sought to come up with at least some reasonable ballpark estimate of the extent to which the health toll in the United States was realistically preventable. One way to address that question is to contrast the United States to comparable advanced industrialized capitalist economies that also operate in the global marketplace, but with different regulatory regimes and different national norms about workplace conditions and practices. In conducting this comparison, we came up with a crucial insight. As countries get richer, they spend more of their income on health and also achieve better health outcomes in terms of levels of population health. As part of spending more on health, the first thing societies tend to do is, for the most part, remedy environmental exposures that lead to disease, death, and excess health care costs. For instance, as countries develop and get richer, they invest in clean water and sanitation to prevent waterborne illnesses. They clean up the air, and by reducing air pollution, prevent various lung and respiratory diseases. Countries also will engage in aggressive programs of vaccination to forestall infectious diseases such as polio, measles, mumps, and pneumonia. To the extent this line of argument, as countries get richer, they eliminate preventable environmental causes of death and illness, holds true, we should expect to observe a negative relationship between a country's per capita income and per capita deaths, or healthcare costs, attributable to specific environmental causes. We gathered data on the relationship between per capita income and the per capita death rate from air pollution and an infectious disease, tuberculosis, for a set of countries in Western Europe and the United States. We looked only at these two environmental causes of ill health, in part, because other possible environmental causes of illness and death, such as waterborne disease or polio, occur so infrequently in advanced economies that data on their mortality consequences are unavailable. As expected, there was a negative correlation between per capita income and per capita mortality from air pollution, with the correlation being negative 0.44. In a similar fashion, there was a strong negative correlation between per capita income and per capita mortality from tuberculosis, with the correlation being negative 0.57. Having demonstrated the plausibility of the relationship between income and death from environmental causes, we extended the same logic to examine the relationship between mortality and health costs arising from the workplace, with per capita income, under the assumption that at least some workplace harms would be preventable and prevented in advanced industrialized economies. Again, we found the expected negative relationship, leaving out the United States. For healthcare costs associated with workplace conditions, the correlation with per capita income was negative 0.60. And for workplace-associated deaths, the correlation was negative 0.65. What is clear is that the United States is an outlier. The United States is statistically significantly in a direction that suggests that healthcare costs and mortality are higher than would be expected given the country's wealth, its high level of per capita income. We next estimated equations relating both mortality and health costs to per capita income, with the United States omitted from the sample used to calculate the regression equation. Once that equation was computed, we simply inserted U.S. per capita income and then could see what the predicted level of mortality and health costs would be for the United States if it exhibited the same relationship between income and the health consequences of workplace practices as the rest of the OECD countries we had studied. When we compare the predicted values to the actual observed values, we have a reasonable estimate of the extent to which the United States could prevent both costs and deaths, just by being similar to this set of Western European economies. Doing this calculation showed that the United States experiences about 59,000 excess deaths and about $63 billion in incremental costs annually compared to what would be predicted given its per capita income. Considering the total toll we previously estimated of about 120,000 excess deaths and $180 billion in costs, our analyses indicate that about half of the deaths and about a third of the incremental costs from workplace conditions appear to be potentially preventable if the United States were more similar to other advanced industrialized economies. Differential exposure to workplace conditions helps explain inequality in lifespans. Inequality is a hot topic, what with growing income inequality not just in the United States, but in many other countries as well. Inequality in health has also drawn increasing research and policy attention. Inequality in health, much like income inequality, has increased over the past decades in the United States and Britain, as well as in other countries. One study reported that, in 2008, U.S. adult men and women with fewer than 12 years of education had life expectancies not much better than those of all adults in the 1950s and 1960s. And that the differences in life expectancies by race and education had widened substantially over time. In the United States, there is a 20-year gap in life expectancy between the most and least advantaged populations. British epidemiologist Michael Marmot noted that, in Washington, D.C., average life expectancy changed by 1 year for people living near adjacent subway stops. For many reasons, including the moral component attached to life and, therefore, lifespans, inequality in health outcomes seems less tolerable than inequality in other things such as income. As Sudhir Anand, an Oxford University-based development microeconomist, commented at a conference on equity and health, "We should be more averse to inequalities in health than inequalities in income. The reasons involve the status of health as a special good, which has both intrinsic and instrumental value. Health is regarded to be critical because it directly affects a person's well-being." More than a decade ago, the World Health Organization decided to measure health inequality as a distinct dimension of the performance of health systems. That is because average achievement is no longer considered a sufficient indicator of a country's performance on health. Rather, the distribution of health in the population is also key. It is well known that socioeconomic status is related to health status, and that there is a social gradient for health. While there are many reasons for expecting people with different backgrounds to have different health outcomes, recently more attention has been focused on the effects of working conditions on health inequalities. As one review noted, It has long been recognized that adults with better jobs enjoy better health than those with less prestigious, less remunerating employment. What previous research has not yet done is to ascertain how much of the inequality in health outcomes comes from differential access to jobs with different amounts of experience.